You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to Tea Break Time Travel, where every month we look at a different archaeological object and take you on a journey into their past. Hello and welcome to episode 32 of Tea Break Time Travel. I am your host, Dr. Matilda Siebrecht, and today I am savouring a strawberry kiwi fruit tea. I thought, why not? Let's go fruity. It's very, very sweet though, so I'm actually quite looking forward to having it later as an iced tea. I think that'll be nice. And joining me on my tea break today is archaeologist, model, editor, all-round awesome human being, Dr. Sascha van der Vaart Verschoof, which I am very proud to say that I can sort of say almost correctly.
Well done. Congratulations.
I'm saying it enough. Who you might know more as the Overdressed Archaeologist, which is the handle of all her digital platforms. So welcome, Sascha. What are you drinking today?
I feel bad now, but I am drinking coffee.
Oh, that's fine. Is it a plain old coffee? Is it a fancy coffee?
It's a latte with oat milk and cinnamon sugar. Oh. So it's a little fancy.
I mean, that sounds very, very fancy. Mm-hmm. I don't usually drink coffee, but I've started drinking more coffee, weirdly, since the second child's arrived. I don't know what the correlation.
I am so surprised.
I don't know what the correlation of that is. But also sometimes when I go into work, I go into Göttingen, which is the city nearby, and I have to get quite an early train. And if I catch the right train, then I'm there with enough time to spare to let me get like a little coffee from the nice little coffee shop in the train station. Mm-hmm. And I usually get a caramel latte. But the other day, she forgot to add the caramel syrup. I took my sip as I was like halfway to work and was like, oh, this is just coffee, which I don't like just coffee. It has to be sweet and sickly for me to like
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yep.
But yeah, anyway, oh well. But are you a coffee drinker in general?
Yes. I also enjoy the occasional cup of tea, but mostly I drink tea when I feel like I've reached my caffeine quotient for the day. But I am a proper Dutch girl in that sense, that I like the coffee quite a lot.
Although, well, you say that though, because apparently the Dutch are the largest tea drinkers in the world.
Really?
Yeah. But more than the British. Which...
Bizarre. Was
a shock to me. So, you know, you say you're a good Dutch girl. Really, a good Dutch girl should be drinking tea at all times.
I mean, also, to be honest, I'm associating the expression of a proper coffee drinker with my father, who drank an obscene amount of coffee daily. And actually, in his opinion, I'm not a good Dutch girl because I drink it without milk. Black coffee apparently the proper Dutch way to drink coffee, not this fancy oat milky stuff.
Yeah, fair. Yeah. Okay. Well, fair enough. Yeah. And do you have final beverage related question? When you have your coffee, do you make it yourself with like a little packet of coffee and do things? Do you have a fancy machine?
I have an espresso machine with a milk foamer.
I mean, that sounds very, very fancy. But indeed,
yes.
Father would be turning in his grave if he knew with a milk foamer.
He'd given up on my coffee habits years and years ago. So I think he accepted it and still loved me. And it's no problem.
That's fair. I mean, that's good of him to you know, put that behind him.
He was a generous soul. Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much again for joining me on tea break, coffee break, hot beverage break.
My pleasure.
Indeed, as I mentioned, you are an archaeologist. You're also plenty of other things, but we will get into that more kind of later. But in terms of the archaeology, what was it about archaeology? What was your path into archaeology? This is something I ask all my guests, and it's so fascinating to hear the range of different ones, but also quite a lot of patterns, I must say. So I'm curious, were you one of the... from birth you knew you would be an archaeologist or did it come later?
No, I mean archaeology and the past was always something I found interesting. My parents were very heavily into taking us into museums and culture and Excellent. All these things. Mm-hmm. And I was, as most archaeologists of my generation, a huge fan of Time Team. So I used to watch that.
Excellent.
Very dedicated as a kid and a teenager. Mm-hmm. And no, actually, I ended up studying archaeology because I couldn't really decide what I wanted to study, but archaeology had always been one of the options. Like, I always doubted between archaeology and something medical biology-ish. Like, I considered being a vet or a doctor or all these different things. And sort of the medical side kept changing. You know, one year I'd want to be a vet, and the other year, maybe I'll be a doctor. But the archaeology was always the other option. Mm. So in the summer where I had to decide what to do, I was starting to lean towards archaeology. And then we went on summer holiday to Ireland, and we went to Newgrange, which is this huge Neolithic monument with lots of fantastical carvings on it. Mm-hmm. And I just went, yep, this is it. I want to know what this is. I want to know more about the people who made it. And I started studying archaeology like 2 months later, and it just stuck. Loved it. Turned out to be good at it. And we went from there.
Excellent. But that's interesting that you say you were interested in kind of medical veterinary, but you didn't want to go down the bioarchaeology route or the zooarchaeological route.
I did consider it. I did do like minors in physical anthropology and that kind of thing. But no, I like artifacts more than I like bones anything like that. So
yeah. Okay. Right. So you became specialized indeed in the sort of material culture side of things, and that itself is very broad, but which direction did you choose to go?
Well, during my bachelor, I started going quite heavily into the Neolithic, and I trained to do usewear analysis on stone. So I did totally unbiased opinion there, Matilda.
yeah, definitely.
My bachelor thesis was on the usewear of wrist guards from the Bellbeaker period. And then during my research master, I started doing a thesis on corded ware hammer axes.
Okay.
And it was about, I don't know, maybe a third of the way through that, when I had a research seminar as part of my degree on the Hallstatt culture and Iron Age elite burials. And I kept finding myself thinking, oh, once I finish this stupid thesis on hammer axes, I can maybe apply for a PhD on this topic, because I was absolutely loving it. I was working as an intern at the museum that had a lot of artifacts from this period. I was studying them and I had all these questions. And at some point I just went, well, this is stupid. Why would I continue doing a thesis that I don't really want to do anymore? And I'm fascinated by this new thing. And I just sort of went with it, changed my topic, wrote a thesis that led to being able to apply for a grant for a PhD, got the grant, and just went nuts for a couple of years.
I feel like that's the best description of a PhD I've ever heard. I got a grant and went nuts for a couple of years. Yep.
It's pretty much that. Yeah. Because on the one hand, you're just absolutely loving all the time you get to spend on the topic that you're so interested in. The rest of the time, you're just, you know, a pile of despair.
Yeah.
And then you get your doctorate and life begins.
Yeah, allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah, no, hey, you're doing great. We're all doing great.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting that you say, yeah, that you decided to switch. I guess a third, it's still early enough that you could indeed switch. Yeah. But I feel like so many people indeed assume that they're just stuck in that, you know, if you specialize in this thing in your bachelor or in your master or even in your PhD, then you're stuck in that forever.
At some point you're past the point of no return and it doesn't make sense to switch. But in my case, it was also for the research seminar. Because I was an intern at the museum, my professors had asked me to create an inventory and a quick analysis of a series of artifacts. So by the time I decided to switch, I was already so heavily into researching that type of material that it sort of evened out where I was with the study of the stone hammer axes. So I was just like, actually, except for the part where I now have to tell my professor that I'm switching to a different professor, that was really the only, yeah. She was very gracious about it. She saw the light in my eyes, as it were, and let me go.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
But yeah, no, I feel quite strongly that you need to love what you're doing, because otherwise, what's the point?
Yes. Oh, I think that should be the theme of the whole archaeology degree. Love what you're doing, because otherwise, indeed, what is the point of doing this? It's not like we got into this for the money and the fame. So
No. And I mean, you have to also be realistic about it, because, you know, it's not always fun and games, but there needs to be at least a little ember of passion for whatever it is you're doing behind it. Otherwise, you're not going to last.
Yeah. Oh, fair. Well, I think that's excellent, excellent advice.
Thank you.
So yeah, so indeed, went into a slightly different direction, specialized more in that, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, I guess, during the discussion. We'll be sharing your insights with us. But another question I asked my guest, because of course this is Tea Break Time Travel. So if you could travel back in time, I feel like I know the answer, but you never know. Some people throw me off and go completely different to what their specialism is. If you could travel back in time, where or when would you go and why?
Oh, that is a good question. I knew I had read you were going to ask me that, and I've changed my answer like four times. I think I would go back to when they were the erection of a megalithic monument.
Ooh.
You know, like Newgrange really has a really passionate place in my heart, just because I find it so fascinating. Wrote my first year's thesis on it. And I'm just so darned intrigued about why they did it and what they were thinking and what it looked like. I always imagine ceremonies and music and, you know, mm-hmm. firelights and all these things. And I'm probably like the erection of Newgrange or one of the Dutch Hunebedden, which is also my type of megalithic grave, mm-hmm. just because it's, I just never lost the intrigue, both how they just technically achieved it, which I think was just, you know, really hard work.
Mm, yeah.
But also the why and what they were feeling and thinking while they did it.
Yeah. And indeed, who was doing it? Like the community aspect of it, like you say, would be really interesting to watch, like to see the
exactly.
dynamics. You know, like,
we think of people having come from really far away to participate in it. Was that true, or was it, you know, was it a relatively quickly done thing with like a huge team of people, or was it more like, should we be picturing the cathedrals, which took generations to erect?
Yeah.
Which in some cases, I guess we already know was the case. Like Stonehenge was sort of redone over several generations at multiple times. But I think that would be my number one thing.
Yeah. Which you also wonder, that just makes me think, I wonder if you had, you know, like, yeah, a generational thing. So if it was, you know, some man or woman or whatever being in charge and then going, yes, this is how we're going to do it. But then at some point they pass on and their son or daughter is going, yes, okay, I know that that's what they said, but actually I have this new vision. Like, we're going to do it this way.
I feel like with Stonehenge, that almost has to be the case. That's what happened, because they did have like, I mean, it was in use for like 1,000 years and redone several times quite drastically. And this is wildly off the point and probably disrespectful to what they were actually thinking in the past. But I often think of it like when I was growing up, my mother would randomly decide, actually, we're going to redo the living room.
Yeah, and, exactly.
You know, my father would lovingly roll his eyes and do it for her because he knew she wanted it, you know, like just like need something fresh.
Probably
there was a lot more thinking behind it with a lot more, you know, ceremonial and symbolic significance to it. But I do kind of wonder if people just wanted to change it up.
or we're trying to just renovate it, like trying to keep it almost like we do with, I recently went to Rome for the first time ever and was looking at the Colosseum, and I found it so interesting, all of the different kinds of stones that have been used over the years to like patch up, you know, all of the different aspects of things. So whether that was a thing as well, it's like, oh, well, okay. And, you know, you had then some people grumbling, being like, well, it's not the original material, and other people going, this stone malarkey is never going to work. And, you know, like it would be,
Yeah, but also, and also like Colosseum's a great example with like every emperor wanting to sort of add to it and make it, you know, add a personal touch to it. Perhaps that's also what happened with all our prehistoric monuments, just a new leader, priest, shaman, whatever you want to call them, feeling like I have to leave my mark here in stone.
Yeah. And it's like you say, it's so funny because you don't think of them as being, you think of them associated with one culture. But like you say, they were around for thousands of years. They're still around. So
they're still around. Yeah,
they've always been used. Anyway, well, yes. Anyway, but moving slightly away from the purpose, but still very, very good point. Very nice journey. I think I'll come with you when you go, because I would also be really interested to see. Before we look at today's object, we're first going to journey back to around 700 BC to a land that we currently call the Netherlands. And I know, by the way, some of you might be thinking, you mean Holland? But after having lived there, I can assure you it's the Netherlands. If you call anyone from the Netherlands and say they live in Holland, they'll get very angry at you. Anyway, moving on. It is night, but the darkness is lit with the sparks and the roar of glittering flames held aloft by a crowd of watching people who surround a freshly dug pit in an already existing mound. Piles of sod lie nearby, and a group of shadowy figures stand beside them with tools at the ready, their face shimmering in the heat of torches. Nearby, a cremation platform has finally stopped smoking, and its contents have been gathered into a huge bronze urn, smooth and bright. Also placed in the urn are various items, metal horse tack, large bits and rings, plus a knife, a whetstone, some finely woven and colourful folded clothes, and finally a sword with inlaid gold handle, its blade curved into a tight ring to allow it to fit inside the urn. The urn is slid into the pit. The watchers stand silently, the sparks from their torches floating up towards the stars. So, today, we are looking at this sword, which I only really learned about from being at a university in the Netherlands, and I haven't seen it that much, but it's incredible. It is called the Sword of Os, which already the name, I'm like, yes. And we'll get into the details soon. But first, let's have a very quick break. So something that I usually like to do at this point, which most listeners should be aware of by now, is to look at the most asked questions on the internet about the object, courtesy of Google search autofill, to see what other people are wanting to find out about this object. However, when I was putting in Sword of Oz or Sword Oz or anything like that, it kept auto-correcting Oz to is. So instead of saying what, you know, Sword Oz, it would correct it to what sword is. And then that wasn't really particularly relevant questions coming up. So it was actually impossible for me to find any questions about this. And so I came up with my own question, which is why is this sword not particularly well known?
Well, it's an interesting question because actually it really is. If you're just looking up sword, it probably indeed won't show up. But if you look up anything slightly more specialist, like it's from a place called Os in the Netherlands, but we call it the Chieftain's Grave of Os in English or Forsterhof in Dutch. And if you look up Chieftain's Grave Os or Forsterhof Os or like Mindelheim, which is the type of sword, or even Celtic Iron Age sword, it will actually often come right up because it's one of the most famous prehistoric sites in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking at like Iron Age archaeology or the Hulsa period, as we call it, or Celtic, which is not a term I love, this sword actually will pop up. And actually, like all throughout Europe, when various museums have large exhibitions on this theme or this period, they will request this sword to be loaned and appear in it. So it requires slightly more specialized Googling, but it is actually a very, very well-known site.
Well, that's good to know because I was getting very disappointed when I was looking this up. I was going, why do not more people know about this? Because like you say, I mean, and I'm going to have some links to this in the show notes. So anyone listening in, do go check the show notes or look up, don't look up Sword of Oz, because like I say, you won't get anything, but look up indeed Chieftain Burial Oz or something like that. It's an incredible sword. I mean, it's beautiful, first of all.
Yeah.
The gold inlay is so clear and the pattern is so amazing. And yeah, it's just bent into this ring, which just looks completely bizarre.
Yeah.
And you mentioned kind of you mentioned a couple of different things in there. You mentioned Mindelheim, Hallstatt, Iron Age, Celtic. So what is the like cultural context, I guess, of this sword or of this burial?
Okay, so we refer to this specific type of sword as a Mindelheim type sword, which just means that it's named after a very similar sword that was found in Mindelheim, which is just how archaeologists it's how we name everything. It's pretty much named either very descriptive, like a full Griffschwert from the bronze age, which just means fully bronze grip, or it's named after a place. And the same is true for the Hallstatt period, which is named after Hallstatt in Austria, which is a very famous site where they have a huge salt mine that was in operation from the Bronze and Iron Age onwards, as well as an extremely rich cemetery from about 800 to 500 BC, which is now the period we call the Hallstatt period. And that name for large parts of Europe is called the Hallstatt period, that period. And in the case of Os, to just make it slightly more complicated, we also call it that because most of the grave goods from the Chieftain's Grave of Os, including this sword, are actually imports from the Hallstatt culture, which is a name we give to sort of a cultural, a material cultural phenomenon around southern Germany and upper Austria that have this specific type of material culture. So it's a period, it's a place, it's a period, and it's a sort of cultural denomination. It gets complicated.
But so you mentioned it's in sort of Germany and southern Austria, but is it also then in the Netherlands? I mean, do you have the Hallstatt culture in the Netherlands? Because you mentioned import.
No.
Okay.
So we have Hallstatt culture. You would not refer to what we have going on in this period in the Netherlands and in Belgium as the Hallstatt culture, but we have Hallstatt culture imports. And this is also pretty much the topic of my PhD thesis, was that these elite graves that have these objects in them are actually the result of a sort of blending of local customs and Hallstatt culture burial customs. So they demonstrate that these people living in what we now call the Netherlands and Belgium actually had a fairly intimate understanding of what these objects were, what they represented, how they should be treated in death. So the interesting thing about that is that there's an area of hundreds of kilometers between being a Dutch person, us and them, where we don't find these things.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it wasn't that it was just sort of gradually seeping through.
No, it was not. I mean, also, with terms of how these objects ended up in the Low Countries, it was not a matter of trading with your neighbor who traded with his neighbor who traded with his neighbor.
Yeah.
We really seem to have a case where it was direct contact over hundreds of kilometers, exchanging objects and ideas, and very tempting to think probably people.
But
it's something we really see only in sort of the elite, rich, high status material goods. If you take them away, there's not really a lot of sign of Hallstatt culture influence in the area. It's just these specific graves.
So it's just the posh people of the region wanted to be like the Hallstatt culture people, so they would order in the specific Hallstatt goods to make themselves look Hallstatt-y.
Well, that is very 1930s thinking of you. We can prove that they had interaction with people from the Hallstatt culture. Mm-hmm. We can tell they imported goods, but we also see cultural understanding of what those objects meant. So it wasn't like just ordering a fancy outfit from somewhere else.
Yeah.
They understood the symbolism associated with these objects and how they should be used. But they then also incorporated very local elements into how they treated them during burial. Like this curling up of the sword was not something that was done in the Hallstatt culture, but it is done in our area.
Okay.
And it's something that we also see in other local graves in our area, that the idea of bending and breaking and destroying grave goods was very much a local custom, not a Hallstatt culture one.
Which, let's get into that indeed a little bit. So for example, this sword, the sword, which I'm going to just call it the Sword of Oz, even though I know that's not the correct in how you pronounce it, but I can't stop thinking about the Wizard of Oz. So the Sword of Oz. Sword of Oz. So what was it actually made from? I mean, would it have been easy to bend?
Also a good question and complicated answer. All right. So first, maybe since it's a podcast, a bit of a description of what this sword actually looks like. Mm-hmm. It is a huge sword with a blade made of iron. It is one of the earliest iron artifacts from the region.
Oh, amazing.
It is above averagely long. An average sword from this period is usually about 90, 95 centimeters. And the Sword of Ulster is 116. So it's already quite oversized. And then it has a handle made in part of wood and other parts probably made of bone or ivory that have not survived. And that hilt is kept on with rivets made of bronze in little diamond shapes with little circular decorations in it. And then it also has gold inlays in the shapes of triangles, some little sort of curved moons, as well as the iconic lightning shaped. They really look like lightning bolts. And what we turned up during my PhD was that it actually originally also had a circle of lead inserted into the handle and slivers of worked bone.
Okay.
So it was very, very much a fancy sword.
Yeah,
also, the complex decoration of the handle also suggests it was not intended for use in battle. I mean, any rigorous use of the grip, the gold would come right out. It's literally just inlaid in little slits.
Okay.
So there's that. And then when it comes to bending it, the issue we have is that in this period, we're not 100% sure what type of iron the blade was made from. So it seems that it is something called soft iron. Later on, it's called hard iron, and it just has to do with how it was processed. Current thinking is that it would have required careful heating and work by someone familiar with metalwork in order to bend it around, because it's really bent into a circle.
So it wouldn't have just been someone getting angry and going,
There's actually a great reconstruction drawing of a similar grave from Belgium from, I'm going to say, the 30s or 40s, where you see a dead chieftain on a pyre, and there's a guy standing next to it wearing what actually looks like a coconut bra made out of bronze object that survived from the site. We now know that these are not, in fact, coconut bras, but various bits of horse tack, but it's a wonderful drawing.
I love as well that you first went to coconut bra, like not just a bra made out of bronze, but a coconut bra.
It's these little discs, these little mounded discs worn on the chest. It's a coconut bra. And he's actually literally standing holding an iron sword of the same type with his knee sort of raised, like he's about to just bend it.
He's about to just bend it on his knee. That's very soft iron.
Yeah, no. So that would not have worked. If you had done, first of all, you would have broken your knee, but also it would not have been able to bend it nicely round.
Yeah.
And we have other blades of the same period that are even more tightly curled up into a circle or bent in various directions. So it would have been, it's not something you could have just easily done by your side. It would have taken a bit of specialized work and control.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that it's also a very complex kind of mixture of materials in the making of it. So not only did you have to have someone who knew what they were doing to bend it, but I'm assuming someone professional, or for want of a better word, would have made it as well. Like, it wouldn't have just been one of the everyday swords that were made.
No. I mean, first of all, everyday swords is already kind of incorrect, because not most warriors would not have fought with swords in this period. It was much more, you know, spears and axes and clubs and that type of thing. Okay. So a sword is already kind of
fancy,
special and fancy.
Okay.
And then this sword, we actually have a couple of them which have this type of decoration, either in gold inlay, or there's some with amber inlay.
Beautiful.
And they're all so similar that we actually think they were made in one workshop, probably in southern Germany.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and they all have varieties of, you know, lightning, sun, and moon shapes in the decor. So they actually do, we always called it sort of jokingly lightning decoration, but it actually might really relate to that, given that they all seem to have,
they all have
variations of this.
I wonder if the person's name was something with lightning, or, you know, like that was his sort of his
could
nickname.
Be. I mean, we also see, especially in the preceding Bronze Age, but also in the Iron Age, quite a hefty obsession with, you know, the movement of the sun and the stars and the sky. So if you imagine you're a people pretty much at the mercy of the weather and the climate, it makes total sense for that to have quite a heavy presence in your conceptual thinking, and also in the art expression
and designs. And interesting. But that's also really fascinating, that idea indeed that they might have all come from one, potentially from one workshop. I've reread The Princess Bride recently, and I'm just thinking of Inigo Montoya going, oh no, they bent the sword that my father made. My name is Inigo Montoya. You bent my sword. Prepare to die.
Nice. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Perfect. Sorry. That's. You can see I'm feeling very intellectual today. But okay. So yeah. So swords themselves weren't very common. These kinds of swords in particular weren't necessarily very common, if it's assumed they're sort of coming from one kind of workshop. Mm-hmm. So that's really amazing. So the other question I have, which I'm sure other people might be thinking as well, is you have this sword, this beautiful sword, beautifully made from Inigo Montoya's workshop, and it's got these lightning bolts in it and everything. And then you decide, A, to bury it with someone, which, you know, we know about that a little bit more, I guess, you know, need weapons for the afterlife and all that kind of thing to help fight your enemies. But why would you bend it? Like, what's the reasoning there?
That's a good question, and one we have theories on, but not a definitive answer. So first of all, for some reason, the people who buried this sword, it was buried in the grave of a man. It was about 30 to 40 years old when he died. Everything seemed to have to fit into his bronze bucket, which was used as an urn. It was a big wine bucket. Mm-hmm. Because the barrow they made over his grave, it was 53 meters in diameter. They could have put the sword in straight. They could have, you know, kept the whole wooden wagon for his horses, everything intact. But they spent quite a lot of time and effort taking everything apart and making it small so it would fit inside this bucket.
Yeah.
So that can be a very practical decision. It can also be like, there's theories about burial urns being like recreating the person's identity, sort of that there was a symbolism to it. So on the one hand, it could be that kind of practical issue. When it comes to swords, you also have to see it sort of in the context of the time, because during preceding periods where most of the Bronze Age, up till the very end of it, it was not culturally accepted to put swords in burials. They would be deposited in wet places, at least speaking for the area where we're talking about now. Mm-hmm. So swords pretty much never went into graves until about 200 years before the chieftain of Ulst was interred.
Okay.
At the earliest. And we see that the swords that first start going into graves, which are bronze swords, are all bent and broken.
Okay.
Or melted, which fits into the local burial custom. Like, people were cremated, and if they had grave goods, they were always bent, broken, fragmented, even giving a little piece of something rather than the whole object. So that seems to have been very much...
And that was intentional. Like, it was done for the burial. It wasn't that they broke their sword.
No. It was definitely done, like, bent, things were bent, things were broken, things were melted on the pyre. So that was... And we think that relates to some kind of shift in cultural thinking, that it used to be taboo to put it in a grave. And then for some reason, they started changing that. They started putting them in graves, but like as a sort of lingering element of the taboo, they would make them unusable.
Yeah. No, it's not a sword. Look, it's a ring. It's very clearly a ring. I know it looks like a sword, but trust me,
this ain't no sword. It could be something like that. We honestly just don't know. But you have to remember, it's not just a sword that was bent. In the case of the chieftain's grave of Ulst, all of his things were sort of taken apart. Like, his wagon was taken apart. The horse stack was taken apart. And then in other graves from the same period with the same type of objects, we have... you know, horse tack being broken and bent. We have bronze vessels being destroyed before they're put in a grave. So for some reason, destruction was a part of how they buried their dead.
Which I guess makes sense if they were cremating as well, because that's also a form of destruction. So you're destroying the body too.
Being able to distribute both the body and grave goods seems to have been important to them. Like, the cremations we find... they usually do not represent a whole person. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the time if you cremate someone, you'll end up with about 2 kilos worth of cremated bone. Mm-hmm. And we find graves with half that, a quarter of that, if not less. So it's like we call it a pars pro toto deposition, where you put in a small piece of something to represent the whole.
Oh.
And they seem to do that with both the objects and the grave goods. Like, we have graves where only a part of the horse tack is interred and a part not. Perhaps because they would take it with them, or they would keep it in their house for a while, or they would take it to a different place, maybe the area they were born, or, you know, a vacation spot they like to go to and leave it part there.
Holiday home, in Hallstatt.
Well, in Hallstatt, for example. But it's something that we still do today. I mean, a lot of people, if they have a cremated loved one, will, leave a part at their vacation home, leave a part at the place where they met their partner, leave some of the cremation remains somewhere else. So it's perhaps also something quite human.
A really fascinating idea as well, in terms of also, but also, like you say, that they built this massive mound that then you just had these tiny little urns in. I guess that makes sense as well in terms of saving space. Very practical. And so in terms of the mound, so you've mentioned quite a few times this idea of elite, of chieftains, of, high status individuals. And I mean, I guess I'm just thinking automatically back to this, the kind of classic stereotype of a chieftain burial. And, it's what you're taught not to think of, I guess, when you're trying to do critical thinking. It's like, don't assume everyone is a chief. But I guess in this case, it's quite clear they are. Or like, how did that sort of... What was it that gave the clue for that, apart from, I suppose, the 53-foot burial mound, or was that the main clue?
It was pretty much the main clue. So it's kind of a complicated thinking, in the sense that when you're doing your archaeology degree, you get told hundreds of times, richness of grave goods does not equal high status. For example, the example you always get is like early 20th century traveler and Romani groups, which are sometimes disrespectfully referred to as gypsies, which were at the time very low status people in most Western countries. But they actually had customs of burying their dead with lots of jewelry. That was their norm. So if you were to actually look at graves from that period, the people who were actually at the time considered high status would have quite poor graves. Whereas these people who were socially considered quite bottom of the ladder would not.
Yeah.
So it's something to always keep in the back of your mind when dealing with archaeology. When it comes to these graves that we're talking about now, it's not just the richness of the grave goods. It's also the type of grave goods, which seem to be related to sort of high status activities, very exclusive activities. Plus, the creation of the burial mound was a community effort. So there's a lot of time and effort put into by a large group of people, which would not generally be done for just about everyone. So that's another indicator of high status. And then when we have the name Chieftain's Grave, that's honestly just a name that evolved in archaeology for this type of really rich burial. Pretty much any grave that's unusually rich in grave goods in archaeology will be start to become a princess grave, a priestly grave, princely burial, king's mound, all these things. But it's just a way for us to indicate someone of unusual high status.
Yeah, because I guess there are enough other graves from this time period and from this culture that are not like that. Like, it's not like these are the only graves we're finding.
No. So it's actually quite interesting. Just 2 years after I finished my PhD on the elite burials of this period in the Low Countries, which is about, my whole thesis is about 70 graves, of which probably 30 are really rich, like the other 40 are sort of rich adjacent.
The wannabes, the wannabe chieftains.
The wannabes, like they'll have something, but they're not quite the same thing. So I had 70. My colleague Ariane Lowen, who finished 2 years later working on all the graves, on what we you know, the people, as it were, of the same period in the same distribution area, he had over 40,000 graves.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's a specific difference. Yeah.
It's, you know, like we sometimes, whenever we give lectures together, we say I'm the 1% and he's the 99.
Yeah.
Which is always quite fun to do because I indeed am wildly overdressed and he's usually the classic archaeologist in jeans and a flannel. But anyway, so it's not even the 1%. It's like the 0.001%. It's a tiny fraction of the people were buried in this way.
Yeah. And I guess it's funny just because probably because they're so interesting and so fascinating, there's probably more publications about those graves than the other graves, but actually there's less of them than the normal graves.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing because there's also this phenomenon. You'd think that, and they are published and discussed and better known.
Yeah.
But actually, because they're so famous, people assume they've been really well studied when in reality, there's a lot of repetition of what has been said without looking into the reasoning behind it. Like my whole career pretty much started when, during this research seminar I referenced earlier, a professor who'd been studying the elite grave, this specific elite grave from Ulster for 20 odd years, asked me to just create an inventory of the grave goods in the grave, which you'd think would be straightforward. It was not. It turned out that it had been restored like 3 times, which meant that the number of objects and the type of objects had changed. It turned out that there was a lot of stuff in the depot that had never been published, that was like taken out of the bucket, and they were like, I don't know what it is, we'll just store it. So it actually took me like 7 months just to come up with a list of what was in the grave.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm not kidding when I'm saying this grave was excavated in the 1930s. I'm the fifth generation of archaeologists to specialize in this grave.
And there you'd think never someone been, would have made a list.
You would think.
You think that would be the first thing to do. That's like the simplest thing to do.
It wasn't because it's also been restored 3 times, by three different generations of restorers. Which is actually one of my favorite things about this grave is that in the 1930s, restoration as a science and a skill was also still being developed, just like archaeology. Mm-hmm. So they took everything out of the bucket. They only recognized a few of the objects, among them the sword. And then they have one inventory number 7.10, which is literally recorded in our book as a clump of rust.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yes. And then in the 60s, it was taken to a new restorer who had some access to like x-rays and stuff. And he took that clump of rust apart and found some horse tack and an axe and stuff. And then in the 1990s, they went even further. And that's when they sort of restored everything into what it is today, which also meant that things like that in the 1930s are published as an iron rod turned out to be an iron toggle. But nobody actually had written down iron rod is now iron toggle. Oh. So you just had to sort of figure out how everything went together. And then, of course, some things were renumbered wrongly, which just happens. So that is truly where my specialty as an Iron Age archaeologist started, was just trying to make a list of what was in the grave.
And then an archaeology of the archaeology, trying to work out what happened with the other archaeologists in the last 100 years. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it sounds, like really amazing research. We're going to have another quick break now so that those listening can have an opportunity to top up their tea, but we'll be back soon. Welcome back, everyone. I hope that the teacups, or, coffee cups as well, are now full and the biscuit jar is empty. So that was, really interesting to hear about the sword, hear about the burials, hear about chief. There are chieftain burials. We were all guys in our archaeology degrees. And we did also sort of introduce, and we kind of went a little bit into your other life as a curator and those things as well already in that last bit. But maybe we can go into a bit more detail now of, how you managed to actually combine all of these different things that you're doing. So at the moment, I think you're working as a curator at the Museum of Antiquities in the Netherlands. Yep. You're also a freelance editor, translator, and researcher for various publications, universities, all sorts of things, projects. Plus, you also do occasional work as a vintage model, which is very, very kind of, I guess they're related, but they're also very different. And also you have a family. You have various hobbies like horse riding, which people who follow you will see on your social media. How on earth do you manage to balance all of those things and keep them all up? What's your kind of, what's the trick?
Returning to the beginning of the episode, the coffee plays quite a big role in all of this. Combination of things. It's on the one hand, I am genuinely someone who loves what they do and a workaholic. So I like having lots of things going. I find lots of things interesting, and I've been lucky enough to have the circumstances to pursue all of them. I mean, I won't lie, there's the occasional breakdown.
Don't we all have
life as an academic? Lovely. Even more than that is I have a very, very lovely and supportive partner. Who, for example, we're we're less than a month away from opening a huge exhibition on the Bronze Age, means that my husband is pretty much taking over most of the childcare household duties just so I can remain functional while we go through this really, really busy period. But I just find if I don't like what I'm doing, I don't do it. I mean, if I like what I'm doing, then I figure out a way to make it happen. And, I'm chronically late with things. Project deadlines pass me by because I'll be working on a different project. I manage it all, but it's not always as smooth or seamless as it may come across if you don't know me personally very well while I'm having the breakdown.
Fair. And you mentioned just quickly that big Bronze Age exhibition. Which date is it opening again?
It is opening on October 18th.
Oh, okay. So those who are listening to this fresh episode, it will be open. It was opened a couple of days ago. If you're in the Netherlands, do go and look it out, because there's another really fascinating sword on display that will be on display. Am I right? The big...
There will be absolutely no shortage of fascinating swords.
My goodness.
In this exhibition. No, there will be an absolute overload of swords and gold and bronzes, but also really cool wooden artifacts. It's an archaeologist's dream, to be honest, to be able to work on it.
Yeah, I really need to try and see if I can visit. How long is it on for?
It's on till mid-March. So you have a little under this 6 time. Months to come visit. Yeah,
I will. Sure. I will do my best because I really want to see it. It looks amazing.
You have to see it.
Yeah. If anyone is visiting the Netherlands in the next 6 months, definitely go to Leiden, go to the Museum of Antiquities, and have a look at it. It looks fantastic. Mm-hmm. Anyway, going back to the job balancing. So, because all of the sort of work that you do is quite different as well in that respect, they sort of have quite different spheres. Do you have a very different approach to kind of the work required in terms of, just logistics of things, just mindsets of things?
Yes, I suppose I do. I mean, first of all, I have learned quite early on that I need to compartmentalize. For example, I use a different email address for different types of work. And I try to limit, for example, like at the moment I have my museum email and I have my own freelance email address and my museum days, which is 3 days a week. Like in the more early morning, I'll check my other email just to check that there's nothing critical happening, and I'll do it at the end of the day. But the rest of the day, that email stays off. So I'm solely focusing on my museum work. Also figuring anybody in my other projects who really needs me that second has my phone number and they will call me. It's just to sort of maintain that peace of mind to be and focus to work on what I'm working on, and vice versa. You know, on my my freelance days, I will check my museum email twice, but other than that, assume and trust that they will call me if anything is critical in terms of timing.
Yeah.
So there's that, and there's also the mindset of do I, for example, if I want to start a new project, whether it's realistic under the circumstances on offer. Like I won't take a job freelancing, editing, or translating if I just know ahead of time that I won't have the time to do it.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, quite a luxurious position to be in these days. Wasn't the case when I first started freelancing. I'd take on pretty much everything just because I was still building my reputation, building my business, building my skill set. Yeah. And I'm now at the sort of luxury position where I can just say, no, I don't have time for that. Or I would love to do that. It is really, really wonderful. And we'll see if it continues to work out, because after the exhibition opens, my contract at the museum ends and I'll be freelancing again full time for the foreseeable
future.
Time for all the jobs. I'm actually giving myself 2 months of not working just to finish all these sort of side quests I've got going on in terms of research projects that haven't been completed, or all these manuscripts of half-written articles that I have piled up. So it's it takes some balancing.
Yeah.
And hard work, but...
And, I mean, you mentioned that, like, when you first started doing a freelance work, you were sort of taking all and any jobs that you could. How did... I mean, if, for example, people are thinking of trying to go into freelance, and I know your freelance work is mainly related to editing, translating, and researching, but if... I mean, I guess it's sort of applicable to anyone who wants to do that kind of thing. What would be the advice that you would give in terms of trying to start out as a freelancer, in terms of making contacts or that kind of thing?
Well, I think, first of all, I give this advice to anybody considering to become an archaeologist or any type of career where work is just not guaranteed in your field, is to have transferable skills. Like the editing business came about because I'm a native speaker, English and Dutch, because I had an American mother and a Dutch father. And when I was a full-time academic, you know, colleagues would ask teachers to just have a quick read of something and check it for them. And then I became an official freelancer, which meant I could send bills for things. And I started when that type of request continued after I'd finished my PhD, I'd be like, oh, well, I can do it, but I'm going to have to charge you just a little bit because I have to pay for childcare now in order to do this. And it just, so I started that way and just started raising the prices as I went. So it's sort of learning to exploit the skills that you have. Like, for example, I have a touch of OCD. Like, I am quite compulsive about things being a certain way, which is actually wonderful for an editor because it means I instantly see if things are not spelled consistently and that type of thing.
Which,
and then
short aside, I had sent Sasha, I sent all of my guests just a very, I call it a script. It's not really a script. It's basically just a list of some of the questions I'm planning to ask, some of the points I'm planning to raise and things. And it's not intended for publication or anything. It's literally just to let the guests know what's coming. I got it back from Sasha with all kinds of spelling corrections and everything. And I was like, oh yeah, I forgot she was an editor.
It's that type of thing.
I very much appreciated it, by the way. I don't mean to say that it was a bad thing. It was just hilarious to get it back. It's the first time I've ever got it back with corrections. I was like, oh wow, I've been doing how many episodes of this now? I'm doing it for a couple of years and this is the first time anyone's said corrections.
Of course, it also helps that we're friends and you know where
I'm
coming from.
Exactly.
To a random person, but it is true. I can't turn it off anymore. And once I realized that was a useful skill, I, you know, did some coursework on it. Like, how do I improve that? And it just sort of grew the reputation. And I got to a place where I could also like charge different rates for different people. Like if I knew someone had quite a lot of funding for their work, or if it was for a well-funded institution, I'd charge a slightly higher rate so that I could also afford to, you know, help the poor PhD student.
Yes. Yeah.
That type of thing. And just sort of commercializing all the skills I have. Like I'm quite good at, I did a lot of supervising of students and PhDs, just like on a very practical note of how do you plan your work? How do you structure your work? Mm. And I turn that into workshops that I'm hired to give. Yeah. So it's, I think the challenge for most people is to know what you're worth and to not, you know, sell yourself for free. And it can be a very small rate or a very high rate, depending on what it is, but that you also are brave enough to just say, I can't do this for free. My time is money.
Yeah.
Especially like in our case, we have a daughter who, if I'm working, either my husband is taking care of her, so it's taking family time away from me, or I'm paying for childcare. Mm. So in which case I would be spending money in order to help someone.
Someone, yeah.
So, mm-hmm. you know, you just have to sort of balance that.
Yeah.
And just develop the skills you have.
Which I find interesting as well. And this was something that, to be honest, personally, I'm struggling with and I need to get better at. And I saw someone else talking about the same thing in terms of developing the skills you have. So actually, yeah, going on courses and learning new things mm-hmm. and developing those skills and everything. Because I suppose that is also, you know, a lot of them cost money and all that kind of thing. So it's difficult to force yourself to do it because it's like, no, I don't want to spend this amount of money on skills I totally already have. But I guess, yeah.
Yeah, but another thing that I've done in that regard is also finding people that you can sort of trade skills with. Hmm. Like from personal interest, I became quite adept at social media, even though I don't do it as much now. And I had a friend who had quite a successful company doing presentation training, like how do you present yourself? How do you present conferences? How do you present yourself on film? And at the time, I started having to do quite a lot of recordings at the museum in different circumstances with different vibes, as it were, very casual, very professional. And I was even though I'm quite a good presenter in most circumstances, as soon as the camera was in my face, I would start losing the charm I have when I speak about things I like. And I was struggling with it. I was talking to him about it and he was mentioning that he was having some issues with his marketing. And so I did an analysis of his social media, gave him some pointers, helped him redesign his strategy. And he gave me a course on presentation. So it cost neither of us anything, but we both got several hundreds of euros worth of free services because we helped each other out.
Which, you know, is how it was done, right? Proper trading goods for goods, you know?
Exactly.
Just trading skills for skills. Yeah. Oh, I like that. That's a nice song. Now I need to try and find people. I don't know. I don't know what skills I'd give them. Do some use work. what do you mean this isn't useful for your current work? Of course it is. It's use work. that's a really good tip. And the final kind of, I guess, question related to this, in regards to any of these jobs, but maybe in terms, you mentioned archaeology is quite difficult to find kind of solid work in. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you wish that you had known when you started your journey into archaeology that you do know now?
Mostly just to recognize that your time is worth something. Mm. You know, especially in academia, there is this spirit of you must be working all the time in order to succeed, and which is, there is a grain of truth in that. You can't be very laid back and lazy and be successful in most fields. But I also decided quite early on that I was going to either be successful on my own terms or not be successful and I figure out something else to do. So I don't work jobs that I'm not comfortable with. I won't compromise my ethics or my desires in life in order to do certain jobs and things. And the same, like for example, I love doing research. I don't love academia. Mm-hmm. So I chose to not be a full-time academic, but still have enough of an academic presence that I still get to do my research projects, which I enjoy. So it's sort of having the bravery, the confidence to make that bold choice and just do what you want to do.
Yeah. Oh, that's so nice. Such nice advice. And I want to just add something onto this as well that sort of relates to that a bit is don't be afraid to ask other people how they've done things too. Because actually, funny story, the reason that Sasha and I became friends, I want to say friends, is because...
You can say friends, definite friends.
I yeah, was following her on social media. And then at some point was like, oh, she just has such a great life. Like, she does archaeology, she does some translate, she has a cool family. How does she manage it? I really wish I knew. And then I thought, well, screw it, let's just message her, because I was also in Leiden, she was also in Leiden. So we'd never met, we'd never even spoken, I don't think, on social media. I think I just kind of stalked you. And I sent her a message saying, hey, this sounds really random, but next time you're in Leiden, do you want to grab a coffee? And I wanted to ask you some questions about stuff. And she was like, yeah, sure. And we met up and you gave some great advice, very similar to what you've given here. And it was the start of a long and beautiful friendship. We've done all kinds of projects since. And yeah.
In general, great advice. If you see someone doing something you want to be able to do, is ask them how they did it.
Yeah.
You know, the same with how to be a PhD. Nobody knows how to be a PhD candidate when you start doing it and you feel really lost and pathetic because everybody knows what they're doing. And then you ask someone, how do you do this? And they'll all go, I have no idea. I'm completely panicking all the time.
And you
realize that's the norm.
Yeah, and everyone has a different route. Like, that's what I always, I like to ask all my guests, indeed, you know, how did you get into archaeology and all this kind of thing? Because everyone has had a completely different answer, like completely different background, completely different route, but everyone still is working in some way related to archaeology. I mean, I've had quite a few like craftspeople on as well, but they're also all related to archaeology still in some way. And it's always so nice to see that there's no one right way to do something.
For sure.
Yeah. Which, on that positive note, I think it's a good place to stop. So I think that marks the end of our tea break. It sounds like, you've got a lot of work to get back to. So I'll let you go back to that. But thank you so, so much for joining me today, Sasha,
thank you for having me.
It's been great to hear from you.
And absolutely.
Yeah. If anyone wants to hear more about Sasha's work or the Sword of Oz, the Chieftain of Oz burial thing, you can check out the show notes on the podcast homepage. Do make sure to look up the picture, because it looks absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
I hope that you enjoyed our journey today. Please do like, share, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to help support this show and of course all the other amazing series that form the Archaeology Podcast Network, you can follow us on social media, or you can also become a member of the APN. You'll be helping us to create even more amazing content, and you'll also have exclusive access to ad-free episodes and bonus content. So for more information on that, check out the homepage at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. I hope that you enjoyed our journey today. If you did, make sure to like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.